This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. There is still unfinished business from last week's midterm elections. House, Senate, and governor's races have yet to be called. Ballots are still being counted and recounted. And re-recounted. We'll talk about what's left to be decided from the midterms, plus the mixed reaction over Amazon's decision to open two HQ2s. Joining us today here in studio is Jeff Mason, White House correspondent for Reuters. Jeff, welcome back to the Roundup.
Good to be with you, Joshua.
Also with us is NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
And NPR economics correspondent John Itzde. John, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Joshua.
More than 60 people are dead and more than 600 are missing after a series of deadly wildfires in California. The Camp Fire in Northern California is officially the most devastating and deadliest fire since California became a state in 1850. Nearly 9,000 homes have been destroyed. Tens of thousands of people are forced to evacuate. In Southern California, the Woolsey Fire near Malibu has killed at least three people and burned about 500 homes. This week, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke held a joint press conference with California's outgoing governor, Jerry Brown. Zinke declared that fighting fires, in his words, is not a Republican or a Democratic issue.
There's a lot of reasons for fire, why we're here. Some is the fire seasons have gotten longer, the temperatures have gotten hotter, the amount of material, the dead and dying timber is elevated. You have the mortality rate of the beetle kill. If you look at a map of Yosemite, and you look at the dead and dying timber in Yosemite. I've spent a lot of time in Yosemite. So I don't want a finger point. What I want to do is how we go from here.
That's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke speaking at a joint press conference this week. Contrast that conciliatory tone with a tweet from President Trump that came 4 days prior, in which the president wrote, quote, "There is no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California except that forest management is so poor. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests. Remedy now or no more Fed payments," unquote. Aisha Roscoe, how do we read the federal government's response to these fires overall?
So the federal government's response, and I think President Trump's Twitter feed, you probably have to separate a bit. President Trump, over the prior weekend, just seemed to really be lashing out at California. I don't know whether he seemed to be settling old scores. He has complained about their forest management before, and for some reason, or he felt this weekend he wanted to kind of threaten them and say that they blame the state government for what was happening. And he caught a lot of flack for that. And you can see on his Twitter feed that his tone has kind of changed. He starts talking about the first responders. He talked about reaching out to Jerry Brown, saying we're with the people of California and the president's going to make a trip there on Saturday. So I think that you've had kind of, like often happens, you have the federal response on the ground that's kind of moving as normal. And then you have President Trump kind of saying things that might sound a little bit different and maybe having to reel it in a bit.
Jeff Mason, what about California's response itself? I mean, particularly, you know, Governor Brown has brought up climate change a great deal as a source of the increasing intensity of these fires. To be fair, Californians have debated for years how much the forest should be cut back to ease fuel in these fires. What's the read so far on how California has dealt with this so far?
Well, I think you're right to mention climate change, number one, because that is one of the core disagreements here that Aisha touched on in terms of the what's behind President Trump's tweets and some of his comments. But Governor Brown, like many Democrats, has been outspoken about the need to fight climate change. And that's one of the core elements of disagreements right now in a country that is divided on many different levels. But climate change abroad is an issue that people agree on in different countries, whether you're from the more conservative or the more liberal side. That is not the same in this country.
I should note that Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, California, has a story on its homepage right now by Ezra David Romero about the debate over how much the forest should be cut back or deliberately burned to prevent major fires like this. You can check out capradio.org for that coverage. John Itzde, give us a sense of the economic impact that a disaster like this has, especially in a state like California, which is our most populous and one of literally the world's big economic centers.
Right. Yeah. You know, tremendous loss of life and emotional trauma and devastating to communities, but also a huge cost, estimated $20 billion cost to insurers and the state government and homeowners. And think about it, back in 2017, a $16 billion cost overall to insurers. That's the claims that were paid. This year, much likely to be much more than that. Enough, actually, a problem for Pacific Gas and Electric, the state's largest power supplier. PG&E equipment may have started this campfire, and so the company could be liable for up to $15 billion in payments. So we could end up with rate increases for consumers, rate increases for businesses. You could see businesses moving out of the PG&E area or even out of the state. It could bankrupt the company itself. Shareholders would suffer. Bondholders would suffer. A state might have to bail out the company. Already, PG&E stock has lost half its value. So a very difficult situation.
PG&E did disclose in a regulatory filing on Tuesday that it experienced an outage on a transmission line in Butte County, that's Northern California, north of the San Francisco Bay Area. It happened on November 8th, just after 6 a.m. Pacific time, 15 minutes before the Camp Fire that has so far claimed more than 60 lives broke out. That's according to what PG&E filed with regulators this week. If there are any more developments with the fire, we'll bring them to you. But for now, let's talk about the midterms, particularly in Arizona, where there was a big upset. Democratic Representative Kirsten Nielsen became the first woman ever to represent Arizona in the Senate and the first Democrat from Arizona to win a Senate seat since the 1980s. Jeff Mason, this is a big pickup for the Democrats.
And correcting the last name, it's Kirsten Sinema.
Sinema. What did I say?
Nielsen, who's the Secretary of
too many Kirsten. And Kirsten Nielsen is in the roundup. So okay. Thank you for not reading 11 pages ahead of my script I did. My X-ray vision went through the script. Kirsten Sinema. Tell us what Kirsten Sinema means for Democrats in the Senate.
Well, number one, it's a pickup for Democrats in what was an extremely close race. Going back to election night, Arizona is not one of the races where I think Democrats were super optimistic that they were going to pick up a seat, although it was certainly possible. This is Jeff Flake's former seat. He, of course, is the current Republican senator who is leaving the Senate. But historical on a few different levels, in addition to being a great gain for the Democrats, she's the first female senator, will be the first female senator from Arizona. She's the first openly bisexual senator in the U.S. Senate, and the first Democrat from Arizona since 1995.
Now, her opponent, Martha McSally, the Republican in the race, painted Kirsten Sinema as this kind of far-left candidate, but John, her voting record's more moderate. How would you describe her politics?
Well, I would say, I think one of the problems that McSally had was that she went negative all the time. But in terms of Sinema, it sounds to me like she is a progressive, and I think she'll add a progressive voice to the Senate. I mean, I find it really interesting that Arizona could elect a senator like Sinema after having elected Flake and McCain. I mean, that shows you just how close this state is divided and how different the politics can be when you jump the divide.
I'm glad you made that point, John, because Aisha, this also feels like it's about kind of the shifting nature of Arizona politics. Like the demographics of Arizona, like many states, are changing.
Yes, and President Trump had really made Arizona kind of ground zero for his immigration pitches and this idea of, you know, we have to get really tough on the border. Remember, this is the state that produced Joe Arpaio, the sheriff who was very, very aggressive and who got a pardon from President Trump, for some of the things that he had been convicted of. And so when you look at having someone like Sinema get elected in this state, there is a question, were they also trying to send a message to President Trump? Because at the end, as we all know, he was focused on the caravan and people coming over the border.
Jeff?
It also made me think of a moment in 2016. I remember being on Secretary Clinton's campaign plane towards the end of the campaign, before obviously the major loss happened, and they were feeling confident overall about the election and beginning to feel confident about Arizona and debating whether or not to go there to campaign in a state that had not been won by a Democrat in a presidential election in ages. This win may have implications for the 2020 Democratic nominee as well.
There were a number of newly elected House Democrats who arrived in Washington for their orientation, to take their class picture on the front steps. This is the most diverse freshman class in history, the most female freshman class in history, including Congresswoman-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Aisha, she has kind of been a figure in the news since she won, including joining this climate change protest outside Nancy Pelosi's office. She has barely gotten her ID card yet.
No, but for some reason, she just gets all this attention. Now, she did unseat a very prominent Democrat, I believe Crowley. Was it Jim Crowley?
Joe Crowley.
Yeah. So she unseated this very popular Democrat who was thought to maybe was going to take over or maybe go against Nancy Pelosi for Speaker of the House if they won. But so I think once that happened, she's just been this lightning rod. And what's interesting is you'll have all these people kind of tweeting about her and saying, oh, she's nobody, she's not relevant. And then they'll send 87 more tweets about her. So for whatever reason, she just gets all this attention. And I think maybe it's because she's very outspoken. She's outspoken about her Latina heritage, and she's outspoken about supporting more socialist ideas and this idea of kind of using socialism as a boogeyman for people who are opponents of that. And so for whatever reason, people want to know what she's doing.
She's also spoken very openly about kind of some of the economic challenges that she's faced. I mean, she got a lot of attention over the past week for telling the New York Times that she could not afford to pay rent on a D.C. apartment until her congressional salary kicks in. On November 8th, she tweeted, quote, "There are many little ways in which our electoral system isn't even designed nor prepared for working class people to lead. This is one of them. Don't worry, BTW, we're working it out," unquote. Jeff, I wonder if the story of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez speaks to something larger in terms of this kind of identity crisis that the Democratic Party's been going through pretty much since Bernie Sanders lost the nomination.
Well, I think it's a fair question. It speaks, number one, to working class roots, which ended up helping a billionaire from New York win the presidential election last year, or in 2016, rather, Donald Trump, instead of a Democrat. It speaks to some of the issues about money and financial inequality. It also speaks to just a generational shift, which has been delayed in the Democratic Party, and which is one of the reasons Nancy Pelosi is struggling right now with her bid to become Speaker again. So all of those issues have come up, and many of them are exemplified by her.
Aisha?
And I think what Jeff talked about, that generational shift, one of the things about Ocasio-Cortez is that she's been able to use Instagram and use social media
very
in a way that older politicians normally have not. So you see her coming in, she's on, she's showing all these little parts of her kind of going through freshman orientation. And that helps her and people want to know about her, but it also kind of just speaks to the differences in the way people reach out now.
Speaking of Nancy Pelosi, we should note that she spoke about the Democratic gains in a press conference yesterday. Here's part of what she said.
I should have said from the start that winning 23 seats in a voter-suppressed, gerrymandered map was a wave. I always knew we would win that, but now getting up to 40, that's really a very big, almost a tsunami.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi speaking yesterday. The House leadership, the House gains for the Democrats is 34 seats. Some projections say that could get as high as 40 seats. Jonathy, what do you make of this blue wave? Did the wave crest? Was it a tsunami? Was it a trickle? What was it?
You know, I found early on election night that the commentary was very bleak. You heard people, anchors, talking about how this was not a blue wave, that the Democrats were underachieving. It was almost panicked, I have to say. But as the night went on, obviously, more seats were gained in the House. Into the next few days, they continued to gain. And so, it may not be a blue wave, but I think it's a blue tide rising a bit more slowly. But I think it's hard to say that the Democrats didn't have a very successful midterm.
We should also note that Republicans elected Republican Kevin McCarthy to be one of their leaders. Aisha, what does that signal about the direction of Republicans in the House and also kind of the way Republicans are dealing with President Trump?
It's interesting. So Kevin McCarthy is very close to President Trump, and President Trump did not weigh in on this race. He was Kevin McCarthy was going up against Jim Jordan, Trump likes both of them very much. I think that it's interesting that you have the Democrats fighting over who's going to be their leader, and they were very successful. And now you have the Republicans who lost, and nobody's really paying a price. You have kind of, they're just kind of moving along with the program. Now, maybe it's because you're in the minority. You don't really have to worry as much about governing because you're not going to really get stuff done. You're just kind of opposing. But it shows that they're kind of just going along with their kind of preset plan. The idea was that Kevin McCarthy would be minority leader since Paul Ryan is moving on.
Let me get to a few of your comments now. Regarding Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at Nancy Pelosi's office, Micah tweeted, "It wasn't a protest. That was what some GOP staffer called it to create division within the Democratic Party." Also want to acknowledge one of you who mentioned something about Alan Page, who was receiving the Presidential Medal of Freedom today. Anita tweeted, "Alan Page is more than just an ex-NFL player. He was a Supreme Court justice in the state of Minnesota, and his foundation has helped send many children to college that would not have otherwise had the opportunity." Thank you for throwing that in, Anita. I believe he was the first black Supreme Court justice in the state of Minnesota. Much more to discuss with regards to the midterms, particularly the fact that day ain't over. Rick in Hyattsville, Maryland writes, "When your guests talk about the ballot counting, please have them explain why all of the votes are not counted before a victory is declared." Good question. One that Floridians are asking themselves. Again, after yesterday's deadline to finish recounting, the machine recount of ballots came and went. Jeff, I am born and raised in West Palm Beach, Florida.
I was just going to say, let's look around the table. Who here is from Florida?
No, let's not, Jeff Mason of Reuters.
Let's ask that person to explain.
Absolutely not, because I don't feel like screaming and yelling or cussing or bursting into tears. I really don't. Because Florida went through this in 2000. I will say, as a Floridian, and all I'll say is that voting, there was a period in Florida specifically where voting got better after the 2000 recount. A lot of activists, particularly Democratic activists, re-educated everyone on how to vote. This is how the machines work. This is how you figure out where your early voting place is. If you are in line when the polls close, do not go home. You are entitled to vote. So voting seemed to get easier for a while. And then Brenda Snipes and Susan Booker and a number of the people who were there before, it seemed like these problems kind of cropped back up. What is going on?
All right. Well, so there's a few different factors there. One of them that you can't ignore is just the fact that Florida is a divided state and is a purple state, and elections are close. And that may seem like a very obvious statement, but if you look at the number of elections that were close this time around, it wasn't, we're not talking about just one election. We're talking about the governor's race. We're talking about the Senate race. I think agriculture commissioner was one of them. So really, really tight races, pretty even divide between Republicans and Democrats, and that triggers, in this case, not only when it's such a close race, it triggers these recounts and additional measures to make sure that the vote is right.
And there was also the matter of Georgia's governor's race that has not been called yet, because on Wednesday a federal judge issued kind of a split ruling that delayed certifying the results. As of yesterday, Brian Kemp, the Republican candidate, was ahead of Stacey Abrams, the Democratic candidate, by by about 55,000 votes. Does this make it easier for us to figure out who's the governor of Georgia, harder? Where does this put us?
Well, it seems like Stacey Abrams is not kind of backing down now, and they may be taking further legal action. I think with some of these races, and especially in Georgia, there was an issue because you had the Secretary of State running in the election. And so you had issues where before the election even happened, you had voters purged off of the voting rolls and all of these things. And then on the day of the election, you had people in line for hours and, you know, not necessarily being able to vote if they had to leave and all of these issues. And so with all of that happening and then the race is close, there can be a feeling that, is this really fair? Is everyone really getting the access that they need to vote? And so that is what the argument that is being made, I think, by supporters of Stacey Abrams and others, that were these, that there are other kind of compounding factors that mean that these races should get closer attention and that we need to do everything to make sure that every vote is being counted.
David emails, how does Brenda Snipes, the supervisor of elections in Broward County, Florida, how does Brenda Snipes still have a job? This whole Florida debacle was caused solely because of her complete incompetence. It's time for her to be removed from her position so votes can actually be counted the right way. John, I'm interested in how you're seeing all this. I mean, you've been at this game for a while, and I feel like the nation really started paying attention to voting after what happened in 2000, understandably. How do you see this whole thing in terms of votes being counted and recounted and us just not being able to end an election on time?
Well, I find it very confusing and kind of astounding that we're in this situation at this point, given all the technology that we have and resources we have to make voting fair and efficient. So it's kind of astounding, but I think it's also true that as many of these states are very evenly divided, and when you get a close election, as Aisha said, you're going to have these issues pop up. So one would hope that we could get this right, but it seems like the closer the elections get, the more trouble we see.
Let's talk about the cabinet now, particularly with First Lady Melania Trump. She made her frustrations public this week about former Deputy National Security Advisor Mira Ricardel, and that left a mark. Jeff, what happened between the First Lady and this former advisor?
Yeah, okay. So first of all, it's worth noting that it's really, really unusual to have a First Lady weigh in as publicly as Mrs. Trump did via her spokeswoman about somebody who doesn't work for her. Somebody who works in the West Wing, and that was Ms. Ricardel, who was the Deputy National Security Advisor. Apparently, this dispute comes down to something related to the First Lady's Africa trip, which I was on, actually, just a few weeks ago, and may have been a dispute over resources or not getting exactly what they wanted for that trip. Bottom line, the press secretary, or I guess the communications director is the appropriate title, Stephanie Grissom, who works for Melania Trump, issued a statement earlier this week saying it is the position of the office of the First Lady that she no longer should have the privilege of working for this White House. And that was just a shot, which ended up leading to her departure.
Is this, what do we make of this? I mean, you said this is kind of unprecedented.
It's certainly unusual. I've been thinking about and talking to colleagues about how unprecedented it is. It is. Nancy Reagan also encouraged her husband, President Reagan, to fire his chief of staff. Right. Other first ladies have weighed in on staffing decisions.
Mrs. Reagan didn't make it public.
She didn't issue out a press release, right?
She had a couple calls with Don Regan, and they didn't go very well. She was trying to keep her husband out of the public after a prostate surgery. And Regan wanted to get him back out on the stump because there were some important issues that needed to be highlighted. And ultimately he got fired, not necessarily over that issue, but he failed to protect the president from the fallout from the Iran-Contra affair. But Mrs. Reagan was very much involved in that.
Yeah, but they were always behind the scenes. And certainly Hillary Clinton and other first ladies were known for being involved, but not publicly. And no, this statement went out. Mira Ricardel was still working for the White House when this statement went out.
Apparently
that said,
in her office.
She was in her office when the statement went out that she didn't deserve the honor of being there. So that is quite unusual to happen. And it does add to the sense of chaos in the White House.
I was sitting with a person from the NSC staff shortly after the statement came out and mentioned it to him that this had come out, and he had no idea.
Yeah. Now, I wonder also, there have been other rumblings about other possible shakeups in the White House following the midterms, which are not unprecedented. I mean, mm-hmm. White Houses change after midterm elections, but there are some reports that suggest the president might have his eye on ousting Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. That's the other Kirstjen I was thinking of.
Yes.
And then White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. There are rumblings about him, too. Jeff Mason, I feel like for those of us who don't work inside the White House, that it can feel like a game of telephone to know what to believe in terms of whose rumblings to take seriously. Like, how should we be reading all this? How should we be thinking through all of these so-called rumblings?
I like that analogy, Joshua, because it's also sort of how it feels to report on it. I mean, you end up calling someone, have you heard this? Have you heard that? And that's part of how the reporting of staff changes at the White House happens. How seriously to take it? I think you have to take it seriously. I think it does seem pretty clear that Secretary Nielsen is probably on her way out. The president has been upset with her handling of sort of implementing his hardline immigration stances on the border and generally on that topic. But her connection to General Kelly is one of the question marks. They're very close. The president and General Kelly have said that he's going to stay until 2020, but there seems to be a cloud sort of perennially hanging over him because it seems like every few months get reports about him being on his way out. So it's unclear, but it is certainly something I think we can confidently say that the president is looking at.
With regards to the new leadership in Congress, Karen in St. Louis writes, "Why is Chuck Schumer a shoe-in? Everyone's talking about whether Nancy Pelosi will keep her job. The Dems won the House. The Dems did not win the Senate. In fact, they lost seats. Why is no one talking about new leadership for the minority in the Senate?" Aisha, what about that?
I think part of it is that because, kind of like I mentioned earlier, when you're in the minority, it's less critical because maybe more in the Senate, because you have more power in the Senate than you do in the House. But I think when you're in the minority, it's more you're just the opposition. You're trying to do what you can to stop things. But I do think, and I also think that when it comes to Democrats losing or not being able to losing seats in the Senate, the map was really against them. Like, they were really on offense and it was really favorable to Republicans. So I don't think that people really expected them to gain seats in the Senate necessarily.
And just to be clear, when you say the map was favorable, you mean in terms of the seats that were up for re-election this time around?
In terms of the seats that were up for re-election, they were in places where Trump had won big and that were favorable to Republicans.
Speaking of the president, Aisha, let me stick with you and talk about his trip in Paris. There were some reports about his trip that were not entirely favorable, but you were on the trip with him. And a lot of the drama seems to revolve around what happened while he was in France, particularly his interactions with French President Emmanuel Macron.
So when he went to when he landed in Paris, right before, he sent this tweet out basically blasting Macron for talking about the need for a European army to protect Europe from Russia, China, and the United States. Now, the French government says that was kind of misinterpreted and that Macron wasn't really saying that that Europe needs to be protected from the U.S. Trump took offense to that and basically said you need to worry about taking care of NATO and handling NATO responsibilities. Of course, the NATO responsibilities are Europeans investing more in their own defense. So that's what Macron said, is basically that by investing in a European army, they are meeting their NATO. They would be meeting their NATO obligations and doing more burden sharing. Now, when the two men met, there wasn't really much drama. I will say that they weren't as buddy-buddy as they can be. Sometimes, you know, Trump and Macron can kind of have like this kind of backslapping camaraderie. That wasn't there. Of course, the other big thing that happened is that President Trump skipped out on this visit to a cemetery on Saturday. And so he spent most of the day kind of just in the ambassador's residence.
Yeah, Jeff, he got a lot of flack for that. There was a lot of, you know, if you follow social media, there were a lot of very creative, very sharp-tongued memes about supposedly him skipping this ceremony because of rain. Is that like, what more do we know about that? Is that
That is true. He was supposed to take a helicopter to the cemetery, and because of the weather, the Secret Service said, no, you can't take a helicopter. So the other option would have been to take a motorcade, and they opted not to do that because it would have been 2.5 to 3 hours drive each way. And that created a lot of flack because he was there to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I and did not go to a cemetery where he could have honored Americans who were killed. That said, you know, the White House also sort of gave differing explanations about why he didn't go. And then I think when the president came back and saw how much heat he was taking for it, he started to lash out.
John?
This cemetery was related to this battle that Marines fought in France that is basically the Iwo Jima of the First World War. So for lots of Marines, this was a really important event.
And he did go to a cemetery the following day, which was already planned. So the trip, he was supposed to go to two, and instead he didn't go to the first one because of weather, but he did go to a cemetery the following day and gave remarks honoring veterans.
One more item out of the administration I should note before we move on. President Trump says he's throwing his support behind a criminal justice reform bill that has bipartisan support. Jeff, what's up with this bill?
Very interesting. And the key word there that is interesting is bipartisan. There's an effort being led by Jared Kushner, who is President Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, to get backing for a bill that has passed the House. Then they sort of used that bill as a model and added a few additional things and are bringing it to the Senate. In that version that is now going to the Senate, it includes some reform to sentencing, in particular getting rid of the on the federal level, the three strikes you're out law, which used to lead to a mandatory life sentence and now will be a 25-year life sentence. It's interesting to see President Trump throw his backing behind it because that may give cover to some Republicans in the Senate in particular, and then when it goes back to the House as well to get behind it.
Ashton tweeted, "The revocation of Jim Acosta's press pass is very concerning. The White House rationale has changed to fit the needs of the legal proceedings. Propaganda is a long game, and Sarah Sanders tweeting of the doctored video of Acosta assaulting the intern is just one more move." Lots going on in that tweet, but just basically the ongoing feud between CNN White House correspondent Jim Acosta and the White House has reached a new high or low, depending on how you look at it. CNN sued President Trump and several of his aides in response to revoking Acosta's press pass, his hard pass, the ID that gets him into the White House. This morning, a federal judge ruled that Jim Acosta's First Amendment rights overruled the White House's right to have orderly press conferences. The judge said he agreed with the government's argument that there is no First Amendment right to come onto the grounds of the White House, but once the White House opened its grounds to reporters, the First Amendment applies. He also agreed, the judge agreed with CNN's argument, that the White House did not provide due process. He said the decision-making was, quote, so shrouded in mystery that the government could not tell me who made the decision. A statement from CNN and Jim Acosta was tweeted out minutes after the ruling. The statement reads, quote, we are gratified with this result and we look forward to a full resolution in the coming days. Our sincere thanks to all who have supported not just CNN, but a free, strong, and independent American press, unquote. John Itzty, I'd love to start with you on this because I heard the name Sam Donaldson thrown around a lot.
I was just thinking about Sam. Sam Donaldson used to disrupt news conferences, and he did it in a very loud way. And he,
former
ABC
News correspondent.
Right. And He was, you know, presidents took it generally lightly, tried to make light of it during the news conference, but I think they were very frustrated in the background. So if there was anyone that has ever disrupted news conferences, Sam Donaldson was it. I don't think anyone ever talked about revoking his press pass.
There's also an exchange I remember Aisha with, I think it was Dan Rather questioning Richard Nixon, where he asked him a question, and the president says, "Mr. Rather, are you running for something?" And Dan Rather says, "No, Mr. President, are you?" And threw it right back at him, and the whole audience kind of fell apart. But we should be real, Aisha. There are mixed opinions among White House correspondents about Jim Acosta, and I don't want to make this personal, but there are mixed opinions among the press corps as to how far is too far when pushing the president to answer a question.
Yes, and because we're not monolithic and we're serving different audiences, we have different bosses, we have different, everyone's working to cover the White House, but we're not all coming from the same place. And so there are people who maybe have concerns about the way Jim Acosta or the way other reporters, any reporter, behave or ask questions, there may be criticism. I think the issue is when you have the government then or the White House saying this is acceptable and this is not. And so who gets to make that decision? Typically with these hard passes, they're security measures. They're not really, you know, based on you being the best journalist there is. They're kind of like secure, you know, you go through a background check and things of that nature. They're not like that. I think sometimes people think that you get them because you're like a great journalist and you're approved. That's not really the way it works. And sometimes you have journalists, you don't even know who they work for necessarily in the White House.
We got a lot of very mixed reactions to y'all about the Jim Acosta story. Lots of reactions, I should note. Curtis emailed, "It seems to me that the White House does have the right to revoke press passes. There's plenty of precedents for this, and they've not abused this power to date. I don't at all agree with what he, meaning the president, has said about CNN, but you have to recognize Acosta willingly chose to ignore the president and has had little respect for him in general." Philip emails, "Just who does Trump think he is? He's accountable to the public. We are not accountable to him. The media serves as a public trustee. It's real simple. If you don't like a certain reporter, just don't call on them." And Martha wrote on our Facebook page, "What's your perspective on the comments that the press corps consider not covering White House press conferences? It's so rare that they provide real information or facts." And she did write gasp in her Facebook note. "Is it time to stop feeding this beast?" Jeff Mason, I'd like you to take on Martha's comment, particularly because you are a past president of the White House Correspondents Association, which works with the White House on matters of credentialing and so forth.
Sure. Well, I don't speak for the Correspondents Association
right
anymore, but I can imagine that my successor, Olivier Knox, who's the president now, will no doubt issue some kind of a statement lauding the decision by this judge today. As far as the listener's comment, look, I would go back to what Aisha said. The White House press corps is made up of a lot of correspondents from different organizations who have different listeners and readers and audiences and bosses. We may disagree on style. We may disagree sometimes on how we do our jobs. But I think it's fair to say that we all agree it is important for the press corps to be able to do its job. And one of the ways that we do that is having the access and ability to go to the White House and to attend press conferences and to ask questions of the leader of the free world.
I do wonder, though, in terms of the overall tone. I mean, Karen tweeted, "Say what you want, both sides behave badly. Access is not a First Amendment right." And I take what she's saying. You know, no right is absolute. There are no absolute rights, including in the First Amendment. Free speech does not include yelling fire in a crowded theater, for example. What does this do, Aisha, in terms of the long game, the relationship between the press and the president, a relationship that has to exist?
It's tough. And I don't know exactly where it goes from here. I don't know how the president will respond to this. I think there's always an antagonistic relationship in some respects between the press and the president. But somehow over decades, as you guys talked about earlier, you've had these run-ins between presidents and reporters, but somehow we've been able to work it out and continue to be able to ask questions and continue to kind of coexist. And so we'll see what happens going forward. But it's not going to be easy.
I know we got to wind down, but I do want to make sure we make time to talk about the big business story of this week, which had to do with Amazon making its long-awaited announcement about where it would build its new headquarters. As it turns out, HQ2 became HQ2 plus one because Long Island City in New York and Arlington, Virginia near D.C. will both become home to Amazon headquarters. Lauren lives in Arlington and writes, "I live in Crystal City, aka National Landing, which is where this headquarters is going to go. While government officials and community leaders are falling all over themselves to give Amazon whatever it wants, many local residents are stunned and concerned. Already our area has been given a new name without our knowledge, and at last night's community meeting, many issues were raised, including increased property taxes that could drive us out of our homes, overcrowded schools, and traffic congestion in this already crowded town." John Itstey, briefly, I wonder if you could talk about where this goes from here in terms of the process of Amazon moving in.
Yeah, I think there are lots of happy officials, lots of happy real estate developers, but as with this woman, lots of worried residents and consumers who are worried about taxes going up, low-income people worried about rents going up. On the other hand, you know, it's a huge change for this area, 25,000 new jobs in Arlington, 25,000 up in Queen. The state of Virginia says is giving Amazon $2 billion worth of incentives over 20 years, but they claimed they were going to get $3.2 billion in return so that they can take care of some of these issues. We'll see.
One more story before we go, at the risk of making one of our guests blush. John Itstey has been with NPR News for 40 years, serving as editor, executive producer, correspondent, bureau chief, and host across the country and around the world. He was there for the fall of the Soviet Union in Pennsylvania, where Flight 93 crashed on 9/11, in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, and at the end of this month, he will retire. We could list more of his big stories over the years, but in the age of Google, you could just search his last name, Y-D-S-T-I-E. Online searches for digital files are a big change from the days of physically cutting reel-to-reel tape, but John has been with NPR through all those changes, helping the network grow and adapt while staying true to its mission. That's Y-D-S-T-I-E. Remember the name. We certainly will. NPR economics correspondent John Itstey. John, thank you for pouring so much of yourself into NPR over the years, and thanks for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Joshua. It was a pleasure.
White House reporter for NPR, Aisha Roscoe. Aisha, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Reuters White House correspondent Jeff Mason. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry. Our digital team is Gabby Healy and Catherine Fink. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
When the world seems out of hand, you can count on the StoryCorps podcast for your dose of humanity. Unscripted conversations between real people about the things that matter most. This season, 12 all-new episodes about reunions and what it means to connect at this moment in our nation's history. Episodes are available every Tuesday.
Tensions between Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United States take a sinister turn. The Brexit divorce is getting really messy, and what was an international bromance has turned rather bitter. Joining us here in studio to help us make sense of what's been happening around the world this week is Rosalind Jordan, State Department and Specials Correspondent for Al Jazeera English. Rosalind, welcome back to the Roundup.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Vivian Salama covers the White House for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Vivian.
Thank you.
And Ron Nixon, Homeland Security Correspondent for The New York Times and author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Ron, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's begin with two key developments regarding the ongoing fallout from the murder of U.S. resident and Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. First, yesterday, the Treasury Department announced sanctions against 17 individuals that the department says are linked to his death. The list included an advisor to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and the Consul General of the mission in Istanbul where Khashoggi was killed. Also, NBC News reports that the White House is exploring ways to remove an enemy of Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, from the U.S. That would be in order to placate Turkey over Khashoggi's murder. NBC reports that the Trump administration has asked about expelling Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen, who's been living in exile in Pennsylvania. Rosalind Jordan, let's start from the beginning with these sanctions. It feels like the U.S. had to do something. In the scale of all the somethings that the U.S. could do, how significant a move are these sanctions?
Well, this is the second round of actions that the U.S. government is taking after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And this is something which the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, had promised a few weeks ago when he first announced that there were going to be visa revocations and visa bans for a number of Saudi officials, mostly mid-level officials, we should stress, in connection with the murder. The Trump administration, and I think our colleagues will agree with me, is under increasing pressure, both within the administration itself and from Congress, to take as strong as possible a response toward the Saudi government, even if that does mean ultimately punishing the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. There is a real sense that if the U.S. allows the murder of a U.S. resident and government critic of whatever government to go unchallenged and unpunished, that other governments will feel empowered to do what has been alleged happened to Jamal Khashoggi, which is he was suffocated, strangled, chopped up, and then his body was dissolved in acid. So, you know, it's this idea that you simply cannot do this to someone who is critical of your government and get away with it.
Rosalind, let me stick with you for a moment. Explain to us why Fethullah Gulen factors into all of this.
Turkey has wanted Fethullah Gulen, who has been in exile in the United States, as you noted, in Pennsylvania, for the better part of 20 years, because Turkey believes that he was behind the attempted coup against the president, Recep Erdogan, 2 years ago in July. He, Mr. Gulen, has denied that he is involved. The U.S. government, under then-President Barack Obama, said, if you present us proof, we will extradite him. But unless you provide absolute proof that shows that Gulen was involved in the coup attempt, we will not turn him over, because we believe that Turkey, which does not have a great human rights record of its own, will do something horrible to Mr. Gulen. The effort in the meantime is that, and this seems counterintuitive, there are people within the administration who want to preserve the relationship with Mohammed bin Salman, and they believe that the Turks are being too hard on the Saudi government because of Mr. Khashoggi's murder. And so this idea has been floated and refuted that perhaps the U.S. would give Mr. Gulen to Turkey as an inducement to ease up on the investigation of Khashoggi's murder. Well, now, it seems really, really, you know, jaw-dropping that such a thing could happen. But there have been people who have said to a number of reporters, including to our organization, there's no such deal in the works. Right. Gulen stays where he's going to stay.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, Ron Nixon. That's exactly what I was going to ask you about. I mean, the State Department must know that if Fethullah Gulen is handed over to the Erdogan regime, he's dead. Like, that is they are handing him over to die.
Yes. I mean, again, Turkey has wanted him there for some time. As you mentioned, he was believed to be behind attempted coup a few years ago. But yeah, if you hand him over to Turkey, he is dead, literally. Which, again, it won't happen. But the idea that it even is considered is incredible. I would like to add one thing about the sanctions, though. You know, a lot of those folks who were sanctioned in this latest U.S. action are people who are under indictment and imprisoned. So it's hard to see exactly what effect these sanctions would have on people who can't travel anyway, or whose assets I'm sure they don't need, since they are imprisoned
right
at the moment.
But well, it could dissuade other people from wanting to provide any support to them or to their colleagues
true.
As this investigation goes forward. So I think it's a more of a deterrent, not that it's actually going to hurt them.
Kind of sending
right.
a message.
Right. But again, I mean, I would say that, you know, someone bold enough to kill someone in a consulate and chop them up and dissolve them in acid, I don't think that, you know, that really serves as much of a deterrent.
I kind of wonder, though, Vivian Salama, you know, what options the White House has had and kind of how this is playing in terms of what the administration can do. Doug tweeted, "Why must Saudi Arabia be punished for one murder when it's American drones and bombs murdering the people of Yemen? The U.S. doesn't have a human rights leg to stand on." I should note that there have been efforts here to move forward with a bipartisan push to end U.S. involvement in Yemen. Some of those efforts were thwarted by some legislative techniques. On Tuesday, the Republican-led House Rules Committee voted to advance the Manage Our Wolves Act. The bill would remove gray wolves from the endangered species list. Set aside how you feel about gray wolves for just a moment, because the Rules Committee waived all points of order against the bill and voted to advance it to the floor. But here's the catch. Language was inserted that blocked a floor vote on whether to direct President Trump to end U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led intervention in Yemen. Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard was not happy with that.
"It is long overdue that we end U.S. complicity in Saudi Arabia's atrocities. We must end all U.S. support for Saudi Arabia's genocidal war in Yemen now."
It's Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat from Hawaii. Vivian, this is not going to go away, is it?
Well, it's definitely not going to go away, and especially since we've got a new House coming in the next couple of weeks. And so it's really up for anyone's guess what will happen moving forward. Obviously, Saudi involvement in Yemen has been a thorn on the side of the U.S. government because of the fact that it has been selling weapons to the Saudi government, constantly having to answer questions on whether or not there's blood on the U.S. hands because of the fact that the Saudis are very heavily relying on U.S. Military equipment. And this is something that the Trump administration has been touting. When President Trump took his first foreign trip last year, it was to Riyadh because he wanted to strengthen that relationship with Saudi Arabia and signal a new era. The Obama administration had really fallen out with Riyadh because of the Iran nuclear agreement, among other things. And so this was supposed to be a big thing. And also his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, really fomenting this bromance, if you will, with the young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. It was really supposed to be a new era. But the problem was that Mohammed bin Salman was also a bit of an unknown. He had already had a record of being a bit of a hardliner. But as a leader, as a ruler of the country, or at least a crown prince of the country who's very much in charge, no one really knew where he was going to go. And so suddenly a lot of these people, including Jared Kushner and others, are learning on the job that you can't really put all your faith in one leader, especially in that part of the world.
Well, and especially because Mohammed bin Salman has been working very hard to kind of project an image of being very forward-thinking and creating a Saudi Arabia of the 21st century, making cultural changes, economic changes.
Sure, but at the same time, he's also very much behind the push to crack down on Yemen and advance their military efforts there. So really, you know, it's a question of what the priorities are for the Trump administration. And for them, they saw a lot of these military deals as potential jobs and money pumped into the U.S. economy. And so that was where they were kind of driving this effort.
But certainly don't forget on November 8th or 9th, November 9th, so that was a Friday, the Pentagon very quietly announced, oh, we're going to stop refueling Saudi Air Coalition aircraft as they're flying these sorties to go after Houthi targets inside Yemen.
Houthis, the rebels who are fighting
to take control of Yemen or split the country back into as it was before the early 1990s. That is, you know, a very definitive view from the Pentagon. This is not worth our credibility. We don't care how much money could be earned by defense contractors. We cannot be involved in the bombing of school buses and in the bombing of apartment buildings and the deaths of thousands of civilians and worsening the humanitarian catastrophe. People are starving. people are being ravaged by cholera and other infectious diseases. Hodeidah, once again, is being contested in terms of control. It's the big port where all the humanitarian aid comes in. And so, you know, there is this schism, as Vivian has very rightly pointed out, on how the administration is going to deal with it. Because on the one hand, you could be dealing with the king of Saudi Arabia for the next 50 years. And on the other hand, human rights violations.
Strong opinions about this whole U.S.-Saudi-Turkey relationship and what's been going on lately. Eric posted, "The Saudi government is no friend at all of the American people or of common decency." And Matt emailed, "Anyone paying attention knew Erdogan was trouble years ago. I hoped the coup would have worked. He is another Putin wannabe." What about this tense relationship? Democrats have retaken the House. Republicans have deepened their control of the Senate. This is not going away. And I think the more that people hear about Turkey and Saudi Arabia, kind of the clearer picture we get of how very heavy-handed Recep Erdogan is, to say the very least, and how transactional the relationship is between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Rosalind, where does this go from here?
Well, I think the first thing that we could say about the Trump administration, and I'm not a historian, is that the foreign policy of Donald Trump has been very transactional. What's in it for the United States? The second point is, many people have remarked that the president likes to work with people who have an authoritarian or nationalist streak, such as himself. And in fact, at his press conference last week, he talked about being proud of being a nationalist, and he didn't see why people thought it was a dirty word. Where does it go with a new Congress? Well, it just so happens that as members of Congress were going through orientation, I took a little trip up to the Hill to watch them go to their workshops and get their handbags of information and how to, you know, do budgets and that sort of thing. And of course, we're trying to talk to the new members. One of the new members is Tom Malinowski, who used to be under the Obama administration, the Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. And my first question to Congressman Malinowski was, are you going to try to get on foreign affairs? And he said, well, I'll see, because my constituents want me to work on tax cuts and getting relief for the tax cuts and on bridges and on education and on fixing health care. But we'll see, because obviously that's where he has built his career. There is a huge interest among these incoming members of Congress in human rights and in the United States regaining its role as a moral arbiter, as it were. But they have very domestic concerns that they have to work on as well.
Let's shift gears to Europe. It's been a week of high drama as the EU and the UK finally agree on the terms of their divorce, better known as Brexit. We've said before here on the Roundup that this is complicated. Here is how the BBC's Chris Mason summed it up.
You know what? People like me are paid, aren't we, to have insight and foresight and hindsight about these things and to be able to project where we're going to go. To be quite honest, looking at things right now, I haven't got the foggiest idea what is going to happen in the coming weeks. Is the Prime Minister going to get a deal with the EU? Don't know. Is she going to be able to get it through the Commons? Don't know about that either.
Am I the only one who thinks that Chris Mason's first choice of a word wasn't foggiest? He caught himself at the last. Am I the only? Okay, thank you. I just want to make sure I'm not the only one on that page. That was Chris Mason of the BBC. But I get where he's coming from, because this week ended with Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May basically fighting to save the Brexit deal and possibly her job. I mean, the deal triggered a number of resignations in her government. Right. There are demands for her to stand down as Prime Minister. Ron, the text of this deal runs above 500
pages. 585
pages. My man counted. 500 and what?
585 pages of an agreement that nobody likes. And because it is not the hard Brexit that the Tories or the Conservatives wanted, and for the people who wanted to stay in the EU, it basically keeps them, because of Northern Ireland. There's a provision in it that says that, well, they have to keep these trade deals going, because you can't have this border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and Ireland.
Because basically, if you trade right. between EU and non-EU, there right. has to be some kind
there
of
has
gate
to be
for
some
trade.
Kind of, yeah. Right, right. So because of that, the people who don't want to exit the EU are saying, well, I mean, you're basically keeping us in without giving us any say into what happens. So again, you know, she's fighting basically two fronts here. The people, again, who want a hard exit, which is why, you know, the negotiator resigned, which is the second negotiator that has resigned, along with a number of other people who were in favor of Brexit, like Boris Johnson, the former foreign minister, who some say may actually challenge May for the prime minister.
Since you mentioned Boris Johnson, yeah. he spoke to the BBC this week explaining why he thinks this whole thing stinks.
For the first time in 1,000 years, this place, this parliament, will not have a say over the laws that govern this country. It is a quite incredible state of affairs. It will mean that we are having to accept rules and regulations from Brussels over which we have no say ourselves. It is utterly unacceptable to anybody who believes in democracy.
That's former British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson speaking to the BBC. But even those who are loyal to Prime Minister May are lukewarm at best, including Rory Stewart, who's the Justice Minister, who sounded a little more upbeat than many.
This is really much more positive than anyone feared. I think the British people would think this is a much better deal than anyone feared. And somehow, something going on in this building at the moment, while the Prime Minister is trying to be, for my money, actually very calm, very reasonable about this, people are trying to be frank, cause trouble.
That was Rory Stewart, the Justice Minister. Vivian?
I want to caution Americans who are listening to this and think, oh, you know, it's a bunch of Brits who have a spat over politics, because the impact of this could actually be really significant to the entire world. Or, I mean, you have folks talking about so Theresa May is out there saying, deal or no deal, we are going to move forward with this on the March 2019 deadline. However, like, if they don't have a deal, the spillover effect could be enormous. Folks are talking about air travel grinding to a halt and supermarkets basically running out of food and food that's already there rotting and all these things that could definitely impact the rest of Europe. But also it could spill over to the United States and otherwise and really disrupt sort of the global system. And so this is a very significant development and folks are getting more nervous as every day passes and there's no consensus.
It's kind of funny. You don't really know how a system works until it seems like it could blow up. So
right.
everything that goes into, like, your favorite, you know, cheese from a certain region in France going from the farm to a truck, to a supplier, to a port, to getting sold, to getting shipped, to getting offloaded, to getting reloaded, to getting stocked, to being sold. All of that is wrapped up in Brexit.
Absolutely. And it's a serious concern. Some folks say that it's a bit of fear-mongering going into it by folks who are not, you know, who want the deal to be made and who want this whole thing to kind of just settle in a peaceful way. Obviously, everyone wants it to settle in a peaceful way, but there are some significant issues involved.
And before we move on and talk France, Rosalind, what about Theresa May? I mean, there are growing calls for a second referendum. There are people who say that they are having, you know, second thoughts about Brexit, what some folks have called the regrexit. She had a news conference this week where she was like, the British people voted for this. My job is to enact the will of the British people, and that is what is going to happen. What does this mean for Theresa May?
Well, she's obviously in a fight for her political career. There's a growing wave of members of parliament or MPs saying that they have no confidence in her leadership. There are people who are already being floated, such as Mr. Johnson, as possible rivals to her being prime minister. There are people quitting her cabinet right and left, although one person who had to quit because of an unrelated immigration scandal, Amber Rudd, is back today as the new Secretary of Work and Pensions. There's a lot of chaos around her government, and that's certainly not helpful as they try to go into what should be a four-month period of finally unwinding this relationship with the EU. So will she actually be able to get to the end of March when the UK formally exits and she will still be Prime Minister, or will there be someone else in the chair? It's really looking more and more tenuous for Theresa May. I'm not an expert on British politics, but I wonder, How can she pull it off?
I see you shaking your head, Ron. Before we move on to France, I see you shaking your head.
I just wanted to say I have the foggiest idea.
Yeah. Right. Was that? Thank you for cleaning it up for the radio.
Did anyone see the British Sign Language interpreter on one of the television stations trying to explain Brexit?
Oh, yeah.
And the look on her face as she's trying to explain all of the machinations this week was worth the price of admission. Right. Just, she didn't have an idea. If Chris Mason didn't know, the interpreter did not know.
Exactly. This feels like an SNL sketch that needs to be shot.
Yeah.
Let's move from the chaos of Brexit to some drama in France. French President Emmanuel Macron summed up this week's visit by President Trump to Paris by saying that he lacks any sense of, in his words, common decency. We talked about this moment somewhat on Monday. Here's what he said on Sunday that seemed to kind of sour the bromance. It's in French, but I'll translate.
Car le patriotisme est l'exact contraire du nationalisme.
Macron is saying patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism. In saying our interests first, whatever happens to the others, you erase the most precious thing that a nation can have, that which makes it live, that which causes it to be great, and that which is most important, its moral values. Vivian, give us your sense of this kind of drama, particularly, you know, the response from the president. He did kind of go right for President Trump between the eyes.
He sure did. So I actually was on the trip with President Trump. I also went on the trip with him last year to Paris, too. And I have to say there was quite a difference in the relationship between Macron. And I have seen the whole evolution just covering the White House over the past year and a half. The first visit was the ultimate romance where the two of them were laughing and shaking hands and everything was great. On this trip, not so much. And it all began with we were at the Élysée and the two of them were sitting together and there was not a smile in sight. I mean, the two of them had the stone-faced looks, and that's because President Trump got there already accusing Macron of insulting him. Literally, we landed, Air Force One landed, and a tweet popped up on our phones because the president was accusing Macron of insulting him by suggesting that it might be time for Europe to take on its own security and form a European military. And this was a one suggestion in a sweeping interview that Macron had done, but the president kind of heard, you don't need the U.S. anymore, and he accused him of insulting him. And the next day, we're all sitting together, no smiles, nothing like that. And then on the last day with the armistice, it was the armistice ceremony, supposed to be a somber event, and Macron clearly took a shot at President Trump. Never mentioned him by name, but everybody knew what was going on, given his comments a few days earlier about nationalism and how it's not a bad thing. And so it was a very tense environment, but also one that really made you question what that relationship is going to look like moving forward.
Yeah, what about that relationship? I mean, the president tweeted that there were a lot of barbs back and forth, right. And I don't want to linger on this too long, but the president tweeted that Parisians had started to learn German during the Second World War before the U.S. saved them from occupation.
Right.
Someone needs to go watch Casablanca again, because there's some drama there he might want to know about. That is a flat-out insult to the French.
Or you could go back further and say the French is the reason that we actually have a country.
Right. Well, yes, right. Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Lafayette
right.
was there in Chesapeake Bay.
Right. Right. Exactly. Right. Exactly. Exactly. Macron seemed irked that some of the angriest tweets came also on what was the third anniversary of the Paris attacks. Mm-hmm. And then the French
Bataclan.
Right. The Bataclan nightclub.
And the grocery markets, yeah.
Right. And then the French army pokes fun at President Trump after he canceled that visit to the World War I cemetery over poor weather. Some have said, I know Vivian, you were telling us earlier that may have been a little bit overblown, that people kind of knew that was going to happen. But the French army tweeted using the hashtag Monday Motivation, and the tweet said, Il y a de la pluie, mais c'est pas grave. There's rain, but it's no problem. And the French army later claimed the tweet was only meant to be about training exercises being held in the rain. Let's come back here to the border between the U.S. and Mexico. The first members of a migrant caravan traveling from Central America reached the border this week. The Trump administration ordered up to 15,000 troops to the border. It also restricted the process by which migrants can apply for asylum in the United States. Ron, Republican Senator Jeff Flake, the outgoing senator from Arizona, called the troop deployment a stunt, but what is it really?
So Jeff Flake, along with a lot of other people, thought and have said that this was a stunt because of the midterm elections, to show this horde in their words, of people coming towards the U.S. And you recall that the Republicans actually put out a video superimposing this cop killer who was an undocumented immigrant with pictures of the migrant. So you notice that the president has not said anything about this caravan since that time, which sort of lends some credibility to the fact that it was about the midterms election and riling up the base to get them to turn out. As of right now, the Secretary of Defense has said that almost 6,000 people that are deployed there, that's what's going to be there. I got an email this morning that Customs and Border Protection, you know, the parent agency of the Border Patrol, is sending people from other areas like Laredo to San Diego area to deal with the caravan. There are about 3,000 people who are in line basically to apply for asylum. So that's where we stand at the moment. And so far, you know, this idea that these people would come running across the border and try to get it, that hasn't happened. It's been pretty orderly. It has overwhelmed Tijuana because of the number of people there, and they don't have the shelter space to deal with it.
Much more we want to discuss as we continue the Friday News Roundup with Rosalind Jordan of Al Jazeera English, Ron Nixon of The New York Times, and Vivian Salama of The Wall Street Journal. Before we pause, one more story that caught our eye this week. Canada is putting a new $10 bill into circulation. It features the portrait of Viola Desmond. Just over 72 years ago, Desmond, who is black, refused to leave the whites-only section of a movie theater in Nova Scotia. Here's a little audio of her sister named Wanda Robson. She's joking around with Canada's finance minister as she's holding one of these new bills.
And don't look at my bill. You can't have it. I saw your eyes stray. Did you see it? Did you see him?
Wanda Robson having a little fun with Canada's finance minister as Viola Desmond's portrait goes on the new $10 note in Canada. Much more to discuss as we continue the roundup, including the trial of one of the world's most notorious gangsters that began this week. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the YMCA, a nonprofit committed to strengthening communities. The Y believes the zip code you're born into shouldn't determine your destiny and works to create opportunity for all, no matter who you are or where you're from. Learn more about the impact of your donation at ymca.net/forabetterus. The Y, for a better us.
Hey everyone, I'm Robin Hilton with All Songs Considered, NPR's weekly music discovery podcast. We know it's hard to keep up with all the great albums coming out each week, so every Friday we do a quick run through the most essential releases. Get New Music Friday from All Songs Considered in the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Let's talk about Joaquin Guzman, the man who became known as El Chapo. The trial of El Chapo began this week in Brooklyn. He is charged with making nearly $14 billion in profits during his 20 years in business, protecting his empire with a sprawling payroll of corrupt officials and an army of professional assassins. That description comes from the New York Times. Guzman was captured early in 2016, later extradited to the U.S. to stand trial. Ron Nixon, remind us about what makes El Chapo a big deal, why the world got captivated by him.
Right. I think El Chapo is sort of since Pablo Escobar, he has become like the drug lord that has most captured the imagination of people because of, you know, his flamboyance. And what I mean by flamboyance, not so much about his dress or showing off his wealth, but how he has escaped after he's been imprisoned. Once he allegedly escaped by paying a guard to put him in a laundry cart and escape that way. But El Chapo is primarily known for tunnels, digging drug tunnels underneath the border. As a matter of fact, the first drug tunnel that was ever discovered in 1990 was done by El Chapo. So that is why there's so much attention paid to him. And he was also on Forbes' list of richest people in the world at one point as well.
But also his arrest, right? I mean, his arrest was a big part of the drama that that surrounded him, because he finally, after being so careful and so dubious for so many years, he gave actor Sean Penn, an interview when they suggested that they were going to do a movie about his life.
Right, he was trying to get
Sean Penn
a movie
an interview, and that's basically what led the feds to him eventually.
I wonder, Vivian, what this says about how much we should extrapolate from this about the overall kind of war on drugs and drug lords. I mean, El Chapo was one very, very unique player. But, you know, what does he signify in a larger sense?
I mean, obviously, it's an era. Pablo Escobar, this is an era where that big drug money and those cartels were really running Latin America, and there's been a real push to try to step away from that. I mean, you see Colombia, sort of the evolution, everything from trying to diminish the power and the violence that were the cartels were behind, but even in recent years making peace with the FARC, who were the guerrilla movement that benefited from the cartels a lot. And so there's definitely been a push to kind of move on to a new era in Latin America.
Ron?
I would say, in addition to that, though, is that the capture of El Chapo and other leaders of the big cartels has led to a fragmentation of these cartels that is made that are led by groups that are actually deadlier than these guys, because they thought of themselves more as businessmen, right? It was about making money, and they used violence when they needed to. But a lot of the people that are running the splinter groups that have that have come out of these large cartels are just about the violence, and so. You know, I did see some reports that suggest that taking out the leadership of these drug cartels, while symbolically, you know, it looks like you're doing something to war on drugs, but it really doesn't stop that flow.
And just consider the fact that the jurors in this case are being held incommunicado.
Right.
We will never know their names.
Right.
In fact, two people at the beginning of the trial this week actually said, I can't do this. I'm afraid for my life. I'm afraid for my family's life.
Right.
And they had to replace two of the jurors in the case because there is a very real fear that El Chapo's allies will go after anyone and everyone connected with this prosecution.
Right. But you remember before the trial started, he did promise not to kill anybody on the jury.
Right.
Yeah. But does he have control over his people?
I'm
just being facetious here. I don't think that's...
Yeah, that will, unfortunately, that will remain to be seen. Let's certainly hope that remains the case.
Right.
Let's shift gears and talk about North Korea. We know one of our listeners, Mike, asked what's happening in North Korea. New satellite imagery from above North Korea shows more than a dozen undeclared missile bases. It's the latest sign that Pyongyang is moving forward with developing its ballistic missile program. Wonder if this goes against any deals made with the U.S. and President Trump. President Trump tweeted on Tuesday in response to a report from The Times. He wrote, quote, "The story in the New York Times concerning North Korea developing missile bases is inaccurate. We fully know about the sites being discussed. Nothing new, and nothing happened out of the normal. Just more fake news. I will be the first to let you know if things go bad," unquote. Rosalyn, what do we make of what the president said, particularly as to whether or not this goes against these latest deals between the U.S. and North Korea?
The biggest criticism of the Singapore declaration, which Trump signed with Kim Jong-un, earlier this year, was that it was not very specific in what was allowed and what was proscribed, in other words, prohibited. And many arms control experts, both within and outside the U.S. government and at the U.N., were very, very critical of that, because basically it gave Pyongyang carte blanche to continue with its military operations. It has always seen the development of a nuclear weapons program and of a ballistic missiles program as essential to protecting its people from exterior threats, not just the United States, but most notably the United States, but certainly protecting it from other countries as well. And so unless you have an agreement that spells out in every inch of a program what is allowed and what is not allowed, how much access international inspectors and unilateral inspectors from individual countries can have, that paper, according to these experts, is worth essentially nothing. So it isn't surprising. And it's also worth pointing out that on Thursday, the Vice President, Mike Pence, said, well, before Mr. Trump and before Mr. Kim have their second summit in early 2019, we don't actually need to have a full list of everything that the North Koreans are doing and are working on and are prepared to launch.
I was actually just going to bring that up. But Vice President Mike Pence did speak to NBC News. They released a story yesterday. And the Vice President, Vivian, I was just going to ask you about this, that Kim Jong-un would have to present what he called a verifiable plan to disclose missile sites. Here is part of what the vice president said.
I think it will be absolutely imperative in this next summit that we come away with a plan for identifying all of the weapons in question, identifying all the development sites, allowing for inspections of those sites, and a plan for dismantling nuclear weapons.
That was Vice President Mike Pence speaking to NBC News during a meeting with Asian leaders in Singapore. He said that the president will have another summit with Kim Jong-un early next year. Vivian, what do we make of this idea that we don't need the list of weapons locations as a requirement before this next meeting? Does that mean anything?
Well, I think that they're trying to determine things through other means. I mean, whether or not the North Koreans provide a list or they get it through their intelligence channels is the big question. I do believe that we have to acknowledge that this has been a very rocky process. And even though the president has come out and tried to put on a very optimistic face to this, his administration is very well aware of the challenges. Secretary Pompeo, he had a trip that was to Pyongyang and then it was canceled. He had a meeting at the UN and then it was canceled. And so this has been a very, very rocky process. And so the administration as a whole, obviously very aware of that. They have experts who have been watching North Korea for a very long time and know how to take their promises with some skepticism because of the fact that we have been down this path before with the North Koreans.
Right.
But for President Trump, obviously, there's a lot at stake. I mean, a lot of credibility in terms of his ability to pull off this epic, historic deal with the North Koreans and basically get them on the right track. And so when he goes out there and says that, it's really to keep people, you know, keep people having faith in him that he will pull it off at the end,
right,
whether or not it looks right now.
And presumably whatever list the North Koreans would provide, we would not just take that on faith.
We well,
would
yeah.
marry that with other intelligence.
Right. And I think if you speak to folks in the intelligence community, even folks at the State Department and elsewhere, they'll tell you, like, you know, we've got our own ways of finding out
right.
what we need to find out.
One quick comment from a listener. Sandby writes, wait, didn't somebody assure us that North Korea is no longer a nuclear threat? Let's talk about the Catholic Church. It and its community continue to grapple with revelations of widespread sexual abuse of minors that span decades and continents. On Monday, the United States Conference of American Bishops gathered for its fall meeting. It planned to vote on reforms to prevent further abuse until the Vatican stepped in. Here's Cardinal Daniel DiNardo speaking at the gathering.
Dear brothers, I need to open our time together with an important announcement. At the insistence of the Holy See, we will not be voting on the two action items in our documentation regarding the abuse crisis. I'm sorry for the late notice, but in fact, this was conveyed to me late yesterday afternoon.
That's Cardinal Daniel DiNardo speaking at the gathering of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. The Vatican asked the leadership of the group to delay voting on reforms until February, when the Pope plans to meet with bishops from across the world. Rosalind Jordan, not only the fact that the American bishops were ready to vote on something is significant, but also the fact that the Pope stepped in to delay it till February and apparently waited until the last minute to do it, so it came as a surprise to the people who showed up to do something.
It looks like a big power play. This is about the Vatican wanting to retain control over its ability and what it would argue its right to punish not just parish priests, but to punish the leaders of the church. When you become a bishop, you're a leader. You're in line to perhaps one day become the descendant of Peter and become Pope. And so because these proposals involved either allowing lay persons, ordinary people who belong to the church, to look at these allegations and to come up with punishments, or to allow the bishops to actually do what critics of the U.S. conference have said they have been unwilling to do for decades, which is root out the offenders and punish them, turn them over to law enforcement. Both of those proposals were very, very strong in theory, but it takes away a lot of the Holy See's ability to actually police its own people. And so this is politics, pure and simple.
Kiran, what does this mean going forward for the relationship between the papacy and American bishops, especially because there is so much legal scrutiny here, the investigation in Pennsylvania and so forth?
Right. I think you'll just see it become more contentious because, again, as Rosalind mentioned, it seems to be a power play here. Look, they've got to do something. Because this is a long-standing problem that the church has been dealing with globally, shifting priests around, not cooperating with law enforcement, and then having to pay out millions, potentially billions of dollars, to the victims of this, and so, they are trying. I think individual parishes are trying to do something. But at the end of the day, it's going to come from the Vatican itself and trying to deal with it. And I think some people, believe that Pope Francis has tried to deal with it. But again, I don't think that he wants to have his authority usurped by, the priests here in the U.S.
Well, it certainly raises eyebrows, too, because look at how the Pope had to deal with the allegations of abuse in the Chilean church.
Right.
Earlier this year, there were many questions about whether he was moving quickly enough, whether he was being tough enough, whether he was disavowing the influence, particularly of one man who was considered an ally of his. And so this just makes things much more difficult for the church overall.
One last story before we end the hour, maybe something a little philosophical to end on. Mm-hmm. We all know about copyright laws and trademark laws, but can you copyright a flavor? A Dutch company tried to copyright the taste of an herb veggie cheese spread. This week, Europe's highest court said no. The company, Lavola Hengelo, tried to claim that similar tasting food products were infringing on its copyright. The court ruled that a taste is more of an idea than it is a thing. Now, the European Court of Justice does have a bit of a precedent here. This summer, it threw out an attempt by Nestle to trademark the shape of Kit Kats.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I love
interesting.
That.
I kind of do. I never would have thought of this.
Exactly.
Because you can trademark like a specific recipe.
Right. But the taste itself.
Well, I think taste is also up for interpretation. Everyone tastes something differently. So there you go.
Right. Exactly. So how do you know if the copyright is infringed or not?
Right.
Exactly.
But the shape of a Kit Kat is the shape of a Kit Kat.
Right.
It's not the shape of a Hershey bar.
Have you had one of the big Kit Kats?
Right.
It's like one big one big
exactly.
bar?
Right.
Exactly. Let that tease your brain over the weekend. Rosalind Jordan, State Department and Specialist Correspondent for Al Jazeera English. Thanks, Rosalind.
My pleasure.
Vivian Salama, White House Reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Vivian.
Always fun.
And Ron Nixon, Homeland Security Correspondent for The New York Times and the author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Thanks, Ron.
Always a pleasure to be here.
1A senior producers are Danielle Knight, Gabe Bullard, and Lindsay Thomas. You can find out more about them and the rest of our staff online at the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.